Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from the car company Scion. As part of its Motivate program, Scion invited 50 semifinalists to LA, where they were provided mentors, attended seminars, and met with advisors. Then, the 10 that most improved received $10,000, a Scion, and continued access to mentors. You can track their success at scion.com.
Today in Studio 360...
If I were a toad, I wouldn't have one big baby in my belly, but many little babies on my back.
In her new TV and online show, Isabella Rossellini looks at mothers, non-human mothers.
Yes, I killed my baby and ate him.
I'll talk with Isabella Rossellini about her new series of funny, slightly creepy web movies later this hour. And a young violinist and singer from Nowheresville, Florida, follows his dream, moves to the big city, starts performing on the streets, and voila.
So I show up and things start gravitating towards me when it comes to sessions.
You're magic, or you're living a fairy tale.
No way, I'm just like following my dreams and not worrying about taxes.
Marquise Tolliver is breaking out, and he'll perform live here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC right after this.
Hello, baby. Nice to meet you. I love your smile.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with Isabella Rossellini about her eclectic life and career. The daughter of film world royalty, an incredibly successful model, an actor in films like Blue Velvet. And now she's making kooky web videos about animal behavior.
What is maternal instinct, the essence of femininity? I think the answer is anything goes.
We'll hear about her latest project, Mamas, which is airing this week on the Sundance Channel. But first, what do you do when your favorite museum of contemporary art and design decides to destroy one of your favorite works of contemporary design? Just recently, the giant Museum of Modern Art announced it was going to demolish its little Manhattan neighbor, the former American Folk Art Museum. This jewel box of a building is only 12 years old and one of the finest pieces of new architecture in New York. People who care about design have been appalled these last few weeks. I myself have been angrily tweeting about it. But then, in the last few days, the Museum of Modern Art decided it maybe shouldn't tear down the building and is going back to the drawing board. Michael Kimmelman is the longtime former chief art critic for the New York Times and now the paper's architecture critic. He is here with me now. Michael, welcome back to Studio 360.
Pleasure to be here.
One of the reasons I was so shocked by this is that over the last 50 years, it seems as though we had gotten to a place in American cities in general, and especially in New York, where great buildings would not be torn down by the whim of some real estate developer. Well, here you have, you know, one of the stewards of modern culture deciding to tear down this great brand new building, and that just does not compute.
Right. This happens more than we think. You know, I was writing some months ago about the destruction of a home built by Frank Lloyd Wright for his son in Phoenix.
But the good guys aren't tearing them down usually.
But usually you do not have a cultural institution dedicated to design, especially modern design, that's doing this. I mean, but you do have conflicts. I mean, architecture is not – it's not like they're ripping up or burning a painting by Gerhard Richter.
It's not
quite the same. Look, I don't want to defend MoMA because I don't think its position is defensible. But one has to say that the museum – has, like other museums, deaccessioned works. That doesn't mean destroyed them, but sold them off in order to build a better collection. That's the logic. It has destroyed buildings before to build what it believed was a better museum. Proof, of course, is in the result. So it isn't entirely unheard of that cultural institutions do sacrifice things in order to improve themselves. I think what was happening here was a museum that has not seemed to be improving itself was doing something that was simply an act of destruction.
In a kind of casual seeming way.
And in a vacuum, because there was no announcement about what the idea was beyond the destruction. That reflected an arrogance and a recklessness that is what I think especially shocked many people and probably reverberated back on the board, the feeling that they were being called on this.
How did the American Folk Art Museum find itself in this predicament of building this beautiful building a decade ago and then saying, take it off our hands, Museum of Modern Art?
I think the Folk Art Museum was like a lot of museums around the country, which banked on a work of exceptional architecture to carry it forward into the future. But by banking, I also mean they spent more money than they could afford. And when the financial collapse came, they were hard hit. And essentially, they were left with a building they couldn't continue to maintain. It's very simple. It's actually happened all over the country.
Now, listeners can see a picture on our website of the building we're talking about, the former Folk Art Museum, designed by Todd Williams and Billy Tsin. How would you characterize it as a work of architecture?
Like a lot of their work, it's about the beauty of craft, and it has a kind of almost a hand-tooled feel to it. It has these very beautiful, seemingly bronzed pieces on the front with a vertical slit between them and a big triangular thing on the top. So it has a feeling almost of giant doors that are slightly open. It's a sculptural object, and it's consonant with the things that were in the museum, the kinds of things the museum collected. Most of all, though, I think, and this is going forward, very important, it's unlike other things on the street and around New York, and that sense of variety and surprise is something that makes a street a wonderful place and is why we love buildings that are varied.
So it is, I think, inarguably, a work of art. So how did the Museum of Modern Art arrive at their previous decision to, by God, we're going to tear it down, and they may still tear it down?
MoMA reflects an attitude of many museums, which is just expansion is necessary, good, inevitable. And it reflects to me a kind of thinking which has become increasingly prevalent in cultural institutions. It seems driven by real estate interests and by – I don't want to use the word corporate because corporate isn't in itself bad. But a kind of mentality of that power and growth and money are the things that drive cultural institutions these days. I mean, I don't mean to sound too fogeyish, but I think at the heart of the response was not only sympathy with the Folk Art Museum and with Billy and Todd, the architects of that museum, but also the lack of sympathy with MoMA. And I suspect that MoMA was very struck by this. I think it's very common with cultural institutions and boards that they become kind of hermetically sealed. They listen to each other. They persuade themselves of their own plans. It's not unique to MoMA. I think it's very possible in a way to be on a board and really lose touch with the public that you supposedly serve.
And I guess the good news is that it proves that, you know, when people rise up and say, no, this is not a good idea, change can happen.
I hope that's true. I mean, it does occasionally happen. It doesn't happen maybe often enough. But it is a lesson that it is very useful to speak up, even against very powerful and seemingly deaf institutions. Once in a while you win.
Michael Kimmelman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Kimmelman is the architecture critic for the New York Times. So what do you all think? Are America's great museums too obsessed with growth and size? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
I live in the mud. I'm brown, fat, and ugly, but I would still find a husband.
Isabella Rossellini offers parenting tips from the animal kingdom.
The eggs that I carry on my back are fertilized. Soon I will be a mama.
I am Isabella Rossellini, and you're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Here are the babies.
Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
If I were a cuckoo, I would often be pregnant. I wouldn't waste energy raising my children. Someone else can do that.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Coochie-coo, coo-coo.
This is the week for greeting card schmaltz and last-second floral deliveries. But I'm guessing that the Mother's Day card you sent did not allude to abandonment, polygamy, or cannibalism.
Yes, I killed my babies and ate him.
But those are authentic maternal instincts for some animal species. And animal mothers are the subject of Isabella Rossellini's new short film series, Mamas. She wrote, directed, and stars in Mamas. And just like her previous short films, Green Porno, which was a series on sex and seduction among insects, Mamas is nothing like a conventional David Attenborough National Geographic nature documentary. Rossellini plays the mother animals. In one film, she's the toad mother dressed up in what looks like a giant hefty bag rolling around until her babies pop out of her back. As the mother cichlid, she wears a giant fish head and holds her baby eggs in her mouth until they hatch. And dressed as a giant hamster, she eats not one but two of her hamster babies for the brood to get down to a sustainable size. Isabella Rossellini, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So Mamas takes our sentimental idea of mothers and motherhood and turns it on its head. And you set out to sort of subvert the nice Mother's Day
idea. Well, it was the study that I read from, you know, the leading researcher, Marilyn Izook. She subverted the idea that maternal instinct means self-sacrifice. She got very alarmed by this idea that the common denominator to all female is to sacrifice, to give to their babies. And she said, okay, let me go out there and see that that is indeed true. Because she was worried as a woman, about studying and becoming a professor at the university. I'm going to be thrown back at the kitchen and serve my family. And when I read it, I had the same concern and the same relief of finding out that the great diversity, the great strategies that they are to perpetuate your genes without self-sacrificing. And that was exhilarating to me, fun and also liberating.
Although there is sacrifice, like the spider who turns herself into baby
Mush.
Food.
Yeah. She turns herself into a baby food.
First my babies eat my limbs. But babies eat only mushy food, right? So to help them, I turn my body into mush.
But as the scientific book that Marlene wrote, this animal is an exception. Most other animals, they don't prove that self-sacrifice is the definition of female, but good management, ability to know your resources and how to make best use of it. So she rather have a definition of female as good managers than self-sacrificing creatures.
And flexible from species to species about how you manage to do this thing.
Exactly.
Why did you decide to do Mamas? Was it you had done animals, insects having sex, and you wanted to show what happens after sex?
Exactly. One of the consequences of sex is maternity. But I went back to universities to study animal behavior. I'm studying for a master's degree. And so,
really?
Yeah, so I read very interesting article about maternal instinct and what do we mean by that. And that was the basis of my new series, Mamas.
And are you still going to school? You're going for the doctorate?
I'm still finishing my master's degree, and I'm studying very slowly because I work, so I can only do a course a semester. So something that might take a couple of years might take me 4 or 5 years.
And how is it being back in school at our age?
You know, I find it wonderful. I heard, actually, on some radio shows that a lot of people my age at 60s go back to school because you have time and it's one way to really engage your brain, especially if you are fascinated by a subject.
Yeah.
This is exactly what happened to me as I work less as a model, as an actress because of age, but I was always interested in animal behavior. I said, I'll go back and study it. And it really filled my day. I mean, as a almost a semi-retired actress, like every person who is retired, you know, you always fear boredom. But I'm not at all because of thanks to the studying.
You have been involved in conservation as an issue for a long time. So were you always a bit of a frustrated zoologist?
I was a frustrated zoologist. And I tell the truth, it's inevitable once you are interested in animal to run into the problem that environment is suffering. But this is not. I wish I didn't have to read about all those bad news. First of all, they are bad news. And also, it's not really my field of interest. My field of interest is really the diversity of animals, their biology, their behavior. But inevitably, you have to face the problem of endangered species, loss of habitat. You know, you have it. And the news are always so sad. So my films, they're trying to be comical.
They are comical, although there's... if not sadness, there's weirdness in them. And Mamas takes our sentimental idea of motherhood and turns it on its head. And I mean, they are comical. As you say, there are lots of funny moments. I especially love when you played the male bumblebee and the oil beetle dupes you into having sex.
And know how to emit the odor that mimics the sex pheromone to attract a male bee eager for romance.
A female. I run! I fly! Ah! The larva crawled on me! Ah, they are all over me! Ah. A female. Or an imposter. I can't resist.
I mean, nature films are not some place where you expect to see comedy. Is that why you're doing it?
In a way, yes. In a way, you know, of course, I am a great fan of David Attenborough of National Geographic. I've watched over and over again their programming. And as a filmmaker, I always felt that I couldn't have done better than they do. So there wasn't any room for me. But one thing that occurred to me is that animal make me laugh. That the variety that you find in nature, it's astounding, but it's also comical. And that was a voice that wasn't expressed. And so maybe I could attempt that. And that's why my film are comicals.
There's also inherent comedy beyond the jokes in this grand dame of the cinema dressed in these ridiculous costumes doing silly things.
The eggs that I carry on my back are fertilized. Soon I will be a mama. Here are the babies.
Well, you know, I thought so. Because when the idea of creating these short films came, I thought, you know, could it be animation? And then I thought, no, it's better if I use myself as an actress because I can control the expression and what, because I know how to do that. And so it became me dressed up as an animal. And of course, I saw that it was completely ridiculous because I'm also identified with great fashion and iconic imagery of cosmetic and fashion. So I thought that it could add to the comical.
And it's why people pay attention to them, right? If it were just another nice animation, yeah.
Exactly. I don't know how they pay attention to it, but, you know, we keep the voice of glamour and beauty, and yet the films are ridiculous.
Did making them, I mean, and really thinking hard about maternal instinct as a universal or not, make you think about your own maternal instincts, mothering styles, all that?
Not so much my maternal ways, but it was liberating to know because like Marilyn Zook, I was a little bit worried that indeed maybe the essence of femininity was to self-sacrifice and that we couldn't really escape that. At the end, we had to serve our kids. And that really made me uncomfortable and thinking, oh, yes, I would like to work. And how do I reconcile that concept?
Well, it's not all or nothing though, right? I mean, sacrifice.
Yeah. No, of course. But Darwin, though he didn't do an in-depth research, but Darwin, with his theory of evolution, he couldn't understand how altruism would exist. If it was the fittest, why would that individual sacrifice itself to be altruistic?
Well, and evolutionary biologists are still arguing about that very thing.
Very much so. But so they looked also at maternity as saying maybe it is a maternal instinct that is expanded to other being than your own babies. But that, of course, it was very much tinted by our own culture that see so right. Women as happy at home and serving the family.
In the Piping Plover short, you have a brief homage to your mother.
Yes.
Was your mother as a mother? Did she figure in your thinking about this series of films?
She figured because this little bird called the Piping Plover that lives, you know, on the shores of Long Island, very close to us, pretends to be wounded to, if she feels that there is a fox or a predator, she pretends to be wounded.
A broken wing. I cannot fly. It doesn't move. Ay, ay, ay.
To attract the predator away from their nest. And then Rook flies off.
I fooled the fox. I pretended to be wounded and unable to fly away to attract the predator away from my eggs.
I'm always amazed how it's possible that evolution evolved to promote lie and pretending and acting. So in my episode, I play a very bad actress who's bombarded by vegetable and tomatoes and rotten tomatoes and booed, chased out of stage. And she says,
if I were as talented at pretending as the Piping Plover, I would be a Sarah Bernhardt, an Ingrid Bergman.
I was looking for a name of an actress that meant the same in many countries because I also did the film in French. So I needed the name of an actress that made the same, how you say, the same... iconic impact. And of course it's Sarah Bernhardt.
Right.
We have never seen her because there is no footage about her, but you think of a grand lady that traveled the world and everybody had to see Sarah Bernhardt at least once. But then when I said Sarah Bernhardt, I said, well, somebody in the audience might know that I'm Ingrid Bergman's daughter. If I don't say Ingrid Bergman, Mama will be offended. So I used both names.
Was her, your experience as her daughter, did you take that and apply that to raising your own children? Or did you say, that wasn't quite right. I'm going to do this differently.
No, I think I really liked my mom. So I think I did very many things like my mom, including acting, including having a career when I went to school.
Marrying directors?
Marrying directors and having a career. But when I was little at school, not too many mothers had careers. My mom was one of the only women, mama, who had a career. And when I was growing up, too, it wasn't like today. Me too. I thought, well, I get married. And then I thought, no, of course I get married with a director like Mama. But I also want to work like Mama because she looked like she enjoyed it so much.
Right. You became, at least in American public consciousness, a movie star rather late in your mid-30s, right?
Yes.
Did you, at that point, did you have a plan or a scheme or a dream of here's how my career is going to play out?
No, I never expected to be as successful as I have been. So, and it was very lucky because it opened many doors. But I somehow always felt that you cannot plan for success. Success either comes or doesn't come. It's like winning the lottery. So I was successful and I felt like I won the lottery.
Right.
But I don't think I can say, okay, now my career will continue that way so that I can foster success. At the end, I just go with my heart, what is interesting to me, what seems valuable to me, and hope for the best.
Isabel Rossellini, it has been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. The Sundance Channel is airing the Mama's Shorts, and they are also available as webisodes online. We've got the details at studio360.org.
With my web, I catch flies. I have to gain weight to nourish my babies, my spiderlings, when they're born.
Here in Studio 360, we like to ask people who come on the show and people who listen to the show the works of art and entertainment that really changed their lives. To celebrate Mother's Day, we'll hear from one of our listeners in Boston, Beth Greenspan. If you look in Beth's purse, you'll find a scrap of paper that she's carried around for a decade. It's a poem by Mary Carr called Entering the Kingdom.
When my son was about 10, or a little older, but about 10 years old, he started to move beyond being a little boy And I started to notice in him the signs that he was moving into adolescence. You know, I noticed that his wrists were starting to get thicker. His hands were starting to look bigger. He wasn't small anymore in the same way. If I held his hand, it was actually almost the size of my own hand, maybe still a little bit smaller, but clearly change was coming and that we were on the cusp of leaving one early phase of his life and coming into the next phase. At about that time, my mom, I think, found this poem by Mary Carr in the New Yorker magazine, and she clipped it and sent it to me. And of course, the moment I received it, it was as if someone had given me a map and painted a picture for me of where we were going. The poem is called Entering the Kingdom, and it's by Mary Carr. As the boy's bones lengthened and his head and heart enlarged, his mother one day failed. I'm sorry, I can't do it without crying, so you're just going to have to be patient with me. I'm going to try to get through it all. Okay, here we go. As the boy's bones lengthened and his head and heart enlarged, his mother one day failed to see herself in him. He was a man then, radiating the innate loneliness of men. His expression was ever after beyond her. When near sleep, his features eased toward childhood. It was brief. She could only squeeze his broad shoulder. What could she teach him of loss, who now inflicted it by entering the kingdom of his own will? As a parent, your job from the minute your child is born is actually to create an exit ramp away from you. And it's what has to happen, it's what must happen, it's what every parent wants to have happen. And yet at the same time, you find that you long for what was.
That's Beth Greenspan talking about Mary Carr's poem, Entering the Kingdom. She listens to our show on WBUR in Boston. Still ahead in Studio 360, a physicist on the cutting edge of the search for dark matter. She's kind of fallen in love with her equipment.
Maybe I'm crazy. It's exciting. It looks symmetric. It looks perfect. It looks shiny.
What do they look like to you?
More like a trash can. An inverted one.
Oh, Antonio, it's very bad. I mean, the coffee pot at least, or the pasta pot, or whatever.
Finding beauty in surprising places. That's in a minute from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Dancing in the dark till the tune ends. We're dancing in the dark, and it soon ends. We're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here, and we're gone.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
We need to find something else to account for more of the dark matter.
These days, one of the biggest quests in science is the search for dark matter.
It is 96% of the universe about which we know nothing.
And a research team based at Columbia University is one step closer to finding it. Right now, in the mountains of Abruzzo, in the middle of Italy, workers are installing the Columbia team's equipment, the most sensitive dark matter detector ever created. it will operate 1 mile underground. The scientist heading up this project is experimental physicist Elena Aprile. And Audrey Quinn found that she's as passionate about the aesthetics of her quest as she is about the science.
Imagine you're walking around in a pitch black room and you keep bumping into something. You can't see it, but you know it's there. That's how physicists feel about dark matter. All their equations for how the universe works, they keep bumping up against it. Dark matter has got to be here. It fills the room you're in right now, but we just can't find it.
It's really very, very scary to know that after all these years of civilization, we still don't know 95% of our universe. It makes you feel very, very small. You want to know what the hell is making the rest of this universe.
The things we look forward to, a special vacation, a birth, a reunion with a loved one, Aprile has that just-can't-wait feeling about finding dark matter.
I guess it's the age factor, or maybe my impatience as a woman in general, as an Italian woman, I don't know. There's no time to lose.
I visited her lab in Irvington, New York. It's about 20 miles north of Manhattan. The building looks a bit like an airplane hangar. This is so big. I had no idea it'd be this big.
Yeah, it's huge. And that crane back there.
That noise you're hearing is the sound of dozens of mini versions of a Aprile's detector. In Italy, the new detector will be about the size of a dunk tank, like at the fairground. A big, shiny, stainless steel cylinder. Here at the lab in Irvington, we're looking at smaller prototypes, about the size of milk cartons.
This is so nice because you have this whoosh, 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 because it keeps pumping. And you have this gas and you hear these sounds, and at the same time, you have this detector filled with this liquid, which is an amazing material.
That's liquid xenon gas. It's cooled to about minus 150 Fahrenheit. Aprile hopes to catch a glimpse of dark matter through this super-controlled environment. A tangle of pipes and wires connects the silver cylinders to special refrigerators and recording equipment. It's all kind of steampunk. But for Aprile, this is more than just lab equipment.
I think all the time of our pieces as art pieces. In the end, if you sit back a moment, you cannot avoid thinking that this is a beautiful. Because when it succeeds and it's a beautiful realization, you say, I made a nice detector. It's a nice piece of art.
Pipes radiate out of the top of one cylinder, like the steering wheel of a ship. The light catches it and forms a little halo. Aprile pulls out a camera and aims it at the small detector.
So right now I saw the light coming through the windows and I wanted to take a picture of it. Whenever a detector is finished and is completed, maybe it's pretentious, but it is a work of art. It is feeling so powerful in a sense, because it came all from your hands. I do feel sometime like a Michelangelo.
Michelangelo? That Michelangelo?
I'm just in love with this sculpture of his. La Pietà is just a beautiful piece.
In the Pietà, a marble statue, the Virgin Mary holds her dead son. His body is draped over her lap.
It's hard for most people to try to visualize how much work has gone into bringing that opera to life. And it's the same way for my detectors.
Maybe there's something about being Italian that makes Aprile think of her machines like Renaissance art. But some of the scientists on her team have a harder time seeing it like that.
Every time I talk to you guys, I always put that it should look also nice. It should look beautiful. I don't know why it looks beautiful. I don't know. It triggers me. It must be, maybe I'm crazy. It's exciting. It looks symmetric. It looks perfect. It looks shiny.
Looks like a space shuttle.
It's a little spaceship. You can see all kinds of things.
We're with Rani Budnik and Antonio Melgarejo. They all look like these little, like, silver R2-D2s to me, like the little robot.
Yeah, they look a bit like that.
What do they look like to you?
More like a trash can, an inverted one.
Oh, Antonio, it's very bad. I mean, the coffee pot at least, or the pasta pot, or whatever.
But whether the xenon detector reminds you of a trash can or the Virgin Mary, hardly anyone is ever going to see it. It needs to be insulated from radiation and cosmic rays, so the working version of the detector has to go deep underground, a mile under the mountains in Italy. And maybe Aprile's concern with the appearance of her detector comes from the fact that its performance is not a given. Scientists don't know what dark matter looks like, so they can only guess at the best way to see it.
Unfortunately, in this business, we don't really know that we're following the right path.
There's a chance that Aprile has spent her career chasing a version of dark matter that doesn't exist. But she doesn't really want to talk about that.
If there is no dark matter particle that we can see in our detector, I can't tell you right now. But sometime I get depressed, but it's no time to get depressed now. I don't think I will ever give up because there's no other way.
For Studio 360, I'm Audrey Quinn.
You can see some pictures of Elena Aprile's detectors at studio360.org. Years ago, you could find the musician Marquise Tolliver performing on streets and subway platforms around New York City. But he wasn't just another scruffy dude with a guitar.
You know I hate sleeping alone, so do your best and hurry home. I dream about the next time we'll see each other. I don't wanna have to wait to see my lover. I dream about the next time I need you now. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, you know, 'cause baby, you control my smile, baby.
He could really sing and play the violin beautifully while doing so. Plus, he's great looking. He is singular, in other words, so voila, he was discovered by the frontman of the hot band TV on the Radio and promptly became a session player in the Brooklyn indie music world. Then he went to London and the fairy tale continued. He was discovered again, this time by an even more famous musician, Adele, who calls him one of her favorites. Marquise Tolliver has just released his first full-length album. It's called Land of Canaan, and he is here with me now. Marquise Tolliver, welcome to Studio 360.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
So you started playing classical violin when you were 10 years old?
Yes.
Was that your idea or your parents' idea?
It was a part of the curriculum at school, so it was no one's idea.
But oh, really? Everybody did it?
Everyone did it.
Really? You were a little Suzuki boys and girls?
Suzuki method. It was a public school, Turity Small Elementary in Daytona Beach, Florida. And we had uniforms that we had to get. Keep in mind, it's a public school, and we had a string program and also a general music course with recorder and xylophones and choir.
That makes me think that American public schools aren't as bad as we hear they are.
I'm 26, so hopefully there's still young string players within the education system in New York and down south that are listening and are into it.
Were you immediately a prize student? Were you good at violin?
Yeah, no? I gravitated to it quite quickly and moved up in the rankings when it came to fourth chair, third chair, second chair, and then concertmaster.
Uh-huh.
For middle school, high school.
And then the transition to caring about and wanting to sing and play soul music and pop music, was that a gradual thing or just at some age you said, hey, I like this?
It was both. The hey, I like this happened when I was singing. I started really singing around the county and stuff at 7 at churches, funerals, weddings, anniversaries, those type of settings. And then I picked up the violin when I was 10 and I hadn't fused the two. I may have started playing violin in church instead of singing in choir. And then when university happened, that's when the theory and all that stuff kicked in more heavily on a day-to-day basis. And I was just forced to do it when I moved to New York because a friend invited me here. And when I showed up at JFK to use the payphone, she wasn't answering her phone. So the only way to make an income that quickly was to start busking. So it just happened out of necessity.
Really? So when you came to New York, just you thought you were going to have be able to stay with a friend?
Well, I showed up the week after she invited me, but I'm the type of guy that, you know, I just hope for the best.
And then you were essentially forced to live by your wits and your talent?
Yeah, man. LGBT Center used the internet for as much as I could on Facebook and found an orchestra buddy from middle school and high school who had moved up to the city. And she let me crash with her for a week and told me, yo, you should go check out Williamsburg. And then from there, I bought a pair of boots and got myself on my way.
Had you ever been here?
No. No, not at all. That was another reason, because it was my first week, crazy, frightening things with no one picking up the phone. And then it being a totally different climate, I show up in October and it's freezing and I'm from Florida. And then,
not just a different climate, a different species of place.
Yeah, I know. But by that time I had seen the film Short Bus. Uh-huh. And so I was just like, yeah, this is going to be wild. This is going to be weird here. So I show up and then just things start gravitating towards me when it comes to sessions with artists like Kip and Dave Sitek from TV on the Radio.
Right. You're magic, or you're living a fairy tale.
No way. I'm just like following my dreams and not worrying about taxes.
And how long did you keep busking and playing on the street?
That's still going on. I started
really?
I did it like 2 days ago, yeah.
What are you making a day doing that?
Enough to eat and hang out.
Like a couple $100?
Couple.
Yeah.
And then from that you get session work, so it adds up. Yeah.
We'll talk some more, but will you play a song?
Yeah, definitely.
What will you play?
The name of this song is called Magic Look.
Great.
Baby, I want you to know you're the one that I hold close to my heart forevermore. Baby, it's magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. Baby, it's a magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. Hey. Baby, I want you to know you're the one that I hold close to my heart forevermore. Sweet, a kiss like chocolate rain. It's so hard for me to even explain. You're the one for me. You're the one for me. You taught me things that I thought I never knew. It's right before me. Baby, there could be no substitute for what's before me. Baby, it's a magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. Yeah. Baby, it's a magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. You make me wanna say, when the candle runs out and you know I can't see, no need to worry, cause you know I will be here in a hurry. No worries for my mind, cause you know that I can be your motivation. I can be everything you want and move. Everything, everything. I'll teach you things that you thought you never knew. It's right before me. Baby, there could be no substitute for what's before me. But baby, it's a magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. Hey. But baby, it's a magic look, look, look you give me, changing the way I feel. You make me wanna say,
that was the singer-songwriter violinist Marquise Tolliver playing Magic Look from his debut album Land of Canaan. Now, some of your music has elements of sort of old-school soul. Some of it sounds like contemporary R&B. Some of it sounds very indie rock. And then there's the indie, there's the solo violin, which mixes it up some more. If you have to say, here are my four great musician influences, who would they be?
I guess I would say Yasha Heifetz, Yehudi Menuhin, and then we could do Frederick Douglass, mixed with Quincy Jones.
Now, you said Frederick Douglass was reading his autobiography was a big influence on this record. How did he inform this record?
I guess the lyricism, the old language, should I say, that's used within his autobiography, and then the depth when it comes to the human condition and what one can overcome. That's helped, I guess, contribute to the whole outlook of the album Land of Canaan, so that it's more of a historical reference as opposed to just like a quick pop song or single to go out. Because I mean, it would be nice if the album went gold or something. But for right now, I'm just hoping to get it out there into people's shelves that collect vinyls and listen to MP3s, as opposed to just trying to listen to something to, like, you know, have a good Friday night. Yeah. I mean, I'm all about that, but
yeah,
I want to have something for Monday through Thursday.
It's called Land of Canaan, which is obviously a religious reference. Were you brought up in a religious family?
I was, and I guess that's why the noun, I guess, spurred some memories from back then when I started singing in gospel choirs and then started introducing my violin into the music ensemble at church. So I guess that story. And then I'm all about Greek mythology. And in a way, the biblical references are just ways of us, you know, learning not to touch the oven because it's hot type of story. So I'm always a fan of mystery, fantasy, and the land of the whimsical. So I guess the Bible can fall into that.
I'm not sure the people that brought you up would necessarily think that, but I'm with you.
Yeah, I think so.
So you were, you know, playing music as a kid. Was there some song or record you heard as a kid that made you really think, I love this, I want to keep doing this, I want to do this with my life?
I guess listening to, like, the Whitney Houston cover of I Will Always Love You back in, like, 92 or 93 when I was living in Tallahassee and, like, in kindergarten. I remember those as, like, one of my vivid memories. Huh. And then Prince's Diamonds and Pearls. But aside from that, I've always had, like, a gravitation towards, like, Western classical music, even as a kid. And, like, it would be on the public radio or whatever. I'd be like, oh, stop. Keep it on that channel.
So you try to – I mean, basically, among other things, you're blending those two strands, the Whitney Houston, Quincy Jones part of your musical
catalog.
Yeah, catalog. Yeah. And being true to the classical music.
I'm trying tradition. To. I totally didn't stick to script for that Magic Look song. I was like putting like new inversions and stuff. I was like, oh, it's okay. It's music. But with the album Land of Canaan, I incorporate Bach's three sonatas and three partitas for solo violin on a song entitled Stay.
Nice to meet you, I love your smile. Not to be shy, but would you care to sit down? Don't wanna just lose you and have you walk on by. There's a possibility that you're the one. Destiny told me to never give up on love. Don't wanna just lose you and have you walk on by.
So on the record, it's much bigger,
yeah,
lusher
it's a big
arrangements.
Ensemble.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I leave that up for the actual performance that I have. Like, say, at the Mercury Lounge, the band will play for a few tracks and I'll do some solo things and we'll weave it in between. The album in itself, I did all the backing vocals and main vocals and the string parts and the guitar, along with my buddy Bart Ustendi, who played bass. So I know I can mix it up no matter what, so the violin will always be there. Even if I'm not playing it, it'll be on stage. And right now I'm just focusing on making sure everyone knows that I make music.
Marquise Tolliver, thank you very, very much.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me here, and thanks for listening, you all. Can't give up
now. Marquise Tolliver's debut album, Land of Canaan, is out right now, and you can hear another live performance he did for us at our website, studio360.org.
You try to convince me I should let you go. Now it's been days, so many days. I don't know what to do. I need you here with me. If only we could start again and write a brand new story.
And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramaswamy,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel. At studio360.org, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, and if that's too much commitment, the show and I are on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. The handles are at Studio360Show and at KB Anderson, that is Anderson with an E.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The life story of Imelda Marcos.
A simple country girl who had a dream.
The notorious former First Lady of the Philippines is now a fantastic disco musical by David Byrne. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.